Thank you, and glad y'all are here for this almost the last session of the conference. I'm going to talk some about a pilot study, some formative research we did, primarily qualitative, with Latino African American families in Los Angeles. And I think the sequence of these presentations has been really interesting because I'm actually going to be talking about our development of a navigation program. So I'm really interested to see that someone else is doing something similar. I want to thank my colleagues that were a part of this, Maricel Robles, Kathy Smith, Leslie Richard, and Michelle Kipke. This has been a unique collaboration, this particular project, with the Children's Hospital, one of the Autism Treatment Network sites. We've been partnering with the Clinical Translational Science Institute, the CTSA, at the University of Southern California. So we've been bringing different resources to this particular project to address disparities. So, as you all know, health disparities continue to exist across many different health domains, and autism is just one of many. Latino African American children tend to receive a diagnosis of ASD later than their white Caucasian peers. We also know, as has been said in all the other talks that we've seen, that the ASD prevalence has been on the rise over the last several years. Historically, the prevalence of ASD has been reported primarily among white Caucasian children, and that is changing as new data are becoming available. But we do see that children of color are more likely to be misdiagnosed. They may also present different symptoms that are not the classic ASD symptoms, and they also tend to receive fewer specialty services than white Caucasian children. And as has already been said as well, early diagnosis is really critical for optimal health outcomes for children with ASD. So we've seen prior research has shown racial ethnic differences in the prevalence of ASD, age diagnosis, severity of symptoms, the time of diagnosis. One study that looked at the analysis of Medicaid claims data showed that Black African American children were diagnosed at a later age, and we're also more likely to be diagnosed with conduct or adjustment disorders than white children, so oftentimes misdiagnosed the first time that they are coming to see a doctor or a clinician. Latino or Hispanic children are also diagnosed on average 2.5 years later than white children. Similar delays for Latino children with other emotional, behavioral, and developmental conditions. So these two groups in particular, we're seeing a lot of different disparities. And that was really the focus of the research that we wanted to look at in Los Angeles, which is a hugely diverse community. Children's Hospital in particular, 80% of the patients that we see are Latino. So we really wanted to think about how we can improve upon these statistics that we see nationally. So we decided to do some qualitative work to obtain the context and the full picture of parents' experiences when they're receiving the diagnosis, with the barriers that they face and challenges that they have. It was really designed to understand these disparities in diagnosis among people of color. So we had a few research questions that we proposed. First off, what's the process parents go through to receive their child's diagnosis for ASD? How do parents of children with ASD access services for their kids? And how do they describe or characterize their experiences in accessing services for their children? To conduct this study, we worked with regional centers, which are the coordinating centers in California that they coordinate services for all people with developmental intellectual disabilities. And we worked with them and other local providers for outreach to families. So just to get a sense of where our families were coming from, we conducted focus groups. We did a total of 10 focus groups with 56 parents. 43 were Latino and 13 were African American. And this just kind of breaks down where they were coming from. If you're not familiar with Los Angeles, this probably means nothing to you. If you are familiar with Los Angeles, it might mean a little something. So the regional centers are dispersed across the county. Lantern Regional Center, which is the first one in this table, is located in Metro Los Angeles. That's geographically a rather small area, but population-wise, it's very, very dense, and it's primarily Latino, Korean, African-American population. Westside Regional Center, as its name implies, is on the west side of Los Angeles, and that is the more affluent area of Los Angeles, so primarily white families. South Central regional centers and South Central Los Angeles, primarily Latino African American families, and then East Los Angeles is primarily Latino. And then we also worked with two other agencies, Fiesta Educativa and Special Needs Network. So most of our focus groups were for the with the Latino families were in Spanish. With the African American families, we actually had some challenges outreaching to some of the African American families. Most of the regional centers have support groups for families, but we realized that when we worked with the different regional centers, they had trouble maintaining focus groups for African American families, and they weren't really sure why that was. So some of our, we kind of thought, well, as we're doing this research, we can maybe explore that a little bit as well and provide them some feedback on that. But we did have some trouble reaching the African American population, but Special Needs Network is a organization in Los Angeles, and they run a summer camp for children with autism, and we managed to go when they were enrolling kids for their summer camp and got a number of African American families there. You also notice, I think it's interesting that on the west side, we had one group, it's labeled African American, but really it was primarily Ethiopian, so there's a large Ethiopian immigrant community on the west side, and so that comprised that group. Okay. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail with all the qualitative quotes and things like I normally would, but kind of talk more broadly about what we found. To look at the first research questions about the process of receiving diagnosis, do we ask parents to kind of describe some of the first things they noticed about their child that they were concerned about, very typical things that you would hear in other populations, delayed or loss of speech. Many parents had the exact same story of their child lining up toy cars and playing with their toys in certain ways, late walker, rocking or spinning, and different behavioral that they saw that were they thought were not typical of other children. We also found that it was really common for these kids to have a dual diagnosis. There's a few parents that their children had been diagnosed with Down syndrome a year or so before they got their ASD diagnosis. ADHD was also very common, or NOS, not otherwise specified, was a big catch-all that a lot of children received before they got to that ASD diagnosis. Many of them actually had the wrong diagnosis. There was one parent that their child had been diagnosed with Down syndrome, was put in special classes, and she kept going back and back to her doctor saying, "My child is not like these other kids." It took 2 or 3 years for that child to actually get removed from that specific program and get ASD services. We also found, and this is one of the things that I found probably most troubling, is parents almost universally, when they first notice these changes in their children or concerns in their child's behavior, would go to their pediatrician, and they were told, almost all of them had the same story, don't worry about it. They would come when their child was 2, maybe 2.5 years old, lost speech. Don't worry about it. If your child's still not talking by the time he's 5, then come back and see me. That's really problematic to hear from a doctor, obviously. When we really probed into some of this, we got a sense from the parents that a lot of them were seeing community clinics, and so they weren't necessarily seeing pediatricians and most definitely weren't seeing developmental pediatricians. So one of the things that we're noticing is that the parents that we're talking to are lower income for the most part on Medi-Cal, going to community clinics where the doctors are not well trained to notice these types of symptoms. One doctor told a parent that, you know, these aren't autism symptoms. Look, I'm looking right at him and he's maintaining eye contact with me. So if he's doing that, he can't have autism. So kind of looking at some of those classical symptoms, and again, children of color may not have the same symptoms. So not really understanding, it's not a cookie cutter issue. Also, parents were really confused because they felt like they had to get 2 or 3 different diagnoses as they were going through this process. First, they had that the regional center provides the official diagnosis for them to get services. But then when their child enters school or after the age of 3, they are qualified for the early intervention services at schools. They felt they had to go through that diagnosis all over again. And that was kind of a semantics issue more than anything, but it was very confusing because, once again, as was said, they get these huge stacks of papers that they have to go through, and it was just a very frustrating process for them. So looking at the third research question, how they characterize the experience in their second and third two, how they access services, We saw that there was a lot of challenges working with providers. Language, especially for Latino families, was one of the issues there. But there were also some cultural barriers that we encountered, particularly among the Latino parents, saying that in our culture, we hold doctors in very high esteem. It's not really appropriate for us to question a doctor. So if they're telling me, don't worry, come back when he's five, who am I to question that? So not really feeling like they have the ability to advocate in that sense. Also, even though it seems like there's a lot of information about autism out there, parents have very little knowledge about it. And I think part of that is that it's still seen as a disease that affects mainly upper middle-class white children more so than other children. And so a lot of the materials that are out there are not necessarily tailored or targeted for different populations, and it's not seen as something they should worry about. They were also very confused because when they finally got to the regional center and got that diagnosis, they weren't ever provided a list of services that they could access. They actually had to know what to ask for. And so if you don't even know what autism is, much less you certainly don't know what services might be helpful for your child. So they were very upset that there wasn't some kind of menu of services or lists that they could go by. So this really points to the need that, you know, it's really important for parents to be able to advocate for their kids. Many parents said that it was really important to bring legal representation when you're going through this with your IEP and at the regional center, and they felt that there was a big disparity in that because, again, upper middle class white children can maybe afford the legal representation that these families could not. So they thought there was an unfair access in that sense. Quite frankly, they found a lot of the providers not very helpful, and they would rely on other parents to really help them, feeling like they've gone through this, they know what they're doing, they can help me. We also realized that there's a very common perception that there's better services based on geography. So I kind of spent a little time explaining where those different regional centers are for a reason. There's a huge perception in Los Angeles that the regional center on the west side of town is providing more services than other regional centers. And in fact, the Los Angeles Times about 3 or 4 years ago had a huge expose on this very issue, that the regional centers in South Central and Metro Los Angeles were not providing the same level of services to their clients, and the cost per child was exponentially different that they were spending. So even though that happened 3 or 4 years ago, we still haven't really seen a change in what's going on. So there's still a perception of services being better on the more affluent side of town and parents using those different zip codes in order to access services there. We also found that, also related to some cultural barriers, that parents felt that their lack of support and process of acceptance from their extended family was oftentimes a real detriment. There was shame and stigma attached to the diagnosis, and that sometimes prevented them from seeking care. In the Ethiopian focus group in particular, we heard that in our culture, you know, the male child is seen as the prince in the family, and if the prince is suddenly given this diagnosis of autism or some other kind of developmental delay, that brings shame to our family. So really trying to think about how you can educate parents about what it means to have autism and how that's not necessarily going to bring shame to the family. There are ways to really celebrate that in its own way. So what we found is that within the qualitative data, really they kind of fell into these three larger buckets. Parent education, and I should actually probably put parent and provider education because there's a lack of awareness in the community providers as well. But education around what is autism. Assistance navigating a very complicated service system that includes the regional center, that includes the school districts, and includes a multitude of other providers that are contracted with the regional centers. And then parental advocacy, so that parents feel that they can question the doctor when they're told to come back, when the child's five, that they feel like they have the skill set to push back. And also for parents to be able to advocate for services once they get that diagnosis so that they feel that they have a fair share of the services. So ideally, if these three things are addressed, we will get to earlier identification of autism and increased access to services is kind of where we're thinking right now. So at this juncture, we're looking at whether this could be accomplished with a promotora or community health worker intervention. And if you're not familiar with the promotora model, essentially it's a Latino model of community health workers that are indigenous to the community settings. They're known entities in their community. They're trusted. They know the schools, the churches, the doctors. They're trained in many different health issues. So bringing these trusted community members in is kind of as patient navigators, essentially. So kind of went over this already with that model. So if we were to use a promotora model to address the identified need, we're thinking that this is really going to help the care coordination improve self-management of the chronic conditions. So these natural helpers within communities, Latino communities, the promotoras de salud, they are really becoming critical participants in prevention of different health issues in Latino communities, like diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular health, and delivery of care as well. So we think these intervention approaches hold real promise, and there's a lot to be done still to evaluate these types of interventions. So where we are at right now, I'm going to flip to this, is we have finished adapting a curriculum, actually, that can be used by promotoras. So we identified this intervention called Developmental Milestones that was developed by the Organization for Autism Research with help from the CDC. It's designed to be presented by promotoras. However, it only, if you think back to the three buckets I had, it really only addresses the one bucket about knowledge. It doesn't work on navigating the system or advocacy. So we wanted to make sure what we were using addressed all three things. So we've used a community-driven process where we've convened working groups comprised of service providers, including folks from the regional centers, from other service providers. Parents of children with ASD and promotoras themselves to sit down and help us adapt this curriculum to make sure that it is culturally appropriate and focused and is understandable to our target population. So we've updated the information on autism based on the latest research, and then we've added those sessions on parental advocacy and linkage to care. Okay, we'll just ignore that for a minute, I hope. We hope and think it's very culturally relevant at this point. It's been infused with Spanish dichos or traditional sayings and different cultural ideals, right, working around familialism and empathy throughout. Right now it's a three-session curriculum to be provided in 2 to 3 hour workshops over 3 days. The target population right now is Latino parents of children 0 to 3 who do not yet have an ASD diagnosis. So that we're looking, trying to catch kids earlier on so they can get that earlier diagnosis. Our thought is that this is something that would be very appealing to other communities as well. So we can, once we pilot this, think about adapting it for African American communities or other groups. So right now we have a grant pending to conduct a pilot and feasibility study for this particular intervention. We're really struggling right now about what the right outcomes are, though, and I'm kind of very interested to see what you're doing with how you're addressing outcomes, since these are not necessarily kids with ASD, and we can't necessarily look at changes in behavior. We have to think a little bit, several steps backwards about what the outcomes are going to be. And that's a picture of one of our promotora working group. I'm the tall one in the back. So the next steps, as I said, we're developing and evaluating the intervention. We are continuing to partner with our communities with this, developed an advisory board to help us with this, and as I mentioned, identifying the appropriate outcomes for our randomized trial. And so I want to thank our parent advisory board and all the community organizations that we worked with to make this happen.
Great. At this time, can I have all the presenters come up to the table? We're going to take some questions and answers, and I really appreciate your presentations today. In terms of kind of what I took from it in a short synopsis, and I'd be interested in hearing our audience's thoughts, you know, we heard the bigger picture from Olivia and Diana in terms of the overall need for access to services, and particularly high-quality services, that a significant proportion, of children with autism still do not receive. And then Diana, including the waivers, gave us a little bit of a state perspective and education, at least for me, in terms of how they ask for resources, how they allot
and figure out the infrastructure for providing those services. And what's concerning is the discrepancy across states, not only in content, but the number of slots and everything. So kind of leads to this, and the need for the navigational programs that then our last two presenters, you know, Katrina and Megan, described two different types of navigational programs that would be useful for particular populations and with children and adults, perhaps with autism. So with that, I thought that was very helpful to me personally, and I really appreciate your presentations.